The Association of Classical and Christian Schools presents Repairing the Ruins, the 2014 Annual Conference, copyright 2014. If you have purchased this recording, you are free to make multiple copies for your school's use. You may not sell copies of the audio or post copies on the internet. Order additional conference recordings from this year's conference or previous conferences at store.accsedu.org. Find out more about the Association of Classical and Christian Schools at www.accsedu.org. Thank you.
Well, welcome. I guess we'll get started. When I come to these things, I sit in the very back row. That's who I am. Yeah, I'm you guys. And I don't like sitting right next to somebody, even if they're a friend. I always have a space between me. So I get it. And yet I'm going to be that kind of annoying teacher that asks you all to move up just a little bit. Because we're going to be doing a lot here. I'm not using the PowerPoint at all. And I'm going to be doing a lot on the whiteboard. So you don't have to get really, doesn't have to be super tight. And if you don't want to, that's fine. I get it. I won't think anything bad. But just encouraging to you to move up a little bit, maybe. All right. I'm Dan Doherty, and I'm just going to shoot straight with you guys from the get-go. I'm no expert, and I know that, somebody will say, oh, I'm no expert, and really, after you hear him talk, sure you're not. I started teaching 7 years ago as a second career. I'm 43, and I've only been teaching 7 years. And my first class, the first place I started teaching was Schaefer Academy, and that's where I still am. I've taught in one school. I have a fantastic team, and when I got there, I was scared to death. And I'm saying this because I get the feeling sometimes that there are a lot of people here who are kind of in that first to third year realm, and you're overwhelmed, and you're feeling like, maybe I'm the only guy. I felt like a fraud for a year or so, maybe 2 years, maybe sometimes I still do. But felt like I'm supposed to be teaching this classical Christian thing that I totally believe in. I did the research, and I chose it for a second career because I love it. And it's the education I never had. Just like that's probably why most of us are in this, especially those of us who didn't go to Hillsdale or something, right? It's the education we never had, and it's the education I want for my kids. I actually chose to teach I knew I was going into education for my second career. I chose to teach in the classical world because we did the research, and I read The Well-Trained Mind. And I thought, I want my kids to have a classical education. And so I want to teach at a classical school. And it's been a fantastic ride, but my first 2 years, it was 90 hours a week of playing catch-up. It was trying to figure out, trying to read everything that I should have read, which I still haven't come close to reading everything I should have read, right? I'm sure that some of you are much more well-read than I am, and I'm just going to, I know you are from listening to some of you talk. I'm just going to say that outright. And so today, I feel grateful for Doug saying what he did about show and tell, that I think I found some tools that are helpful, and I hope they're helpful for you guys. And I'm just kind of excited about them and here to do a little show and tell. So that's what this is. It'll hopefully be pretty practical for your classroom as well. I am going to do some kind of, big picture stuff, but hopefully we'll get pretty quickly into real classroom how to use this. I also have a tendency to put my foot in my mouth often, so we're going to pray here so that doesn't happen. Hopefully. Lord Jesus, thank you so much for your grace. Thank you that a bruised reed you will not break. And so many of us feel like bruised reeds in this profession, in this very young thing called classical education, very old thing, and yet in many ways very young, and we're all still trying to figure it out. Thank you for your grace, for the fellowship that you've given us to sharpen one another. Pray that today, that my speech would be seasoned with salt. Pray that you take these few crumbs and multiply them, that we really could feast from your wisdom, Lord. So we give you today in your name. Amen. Do the kids really need to read Edgar Allan Poe? He's so dark. A concerned mother. You know that teaching fiction is really just teaching lies. A dogmatic father. I had that conversation. A pastor, actually. Are they a Christian band? An incredulous student pointing at the speakers on my desk. I had to admit, of course, no, they're not. But they're good. You ought to try them, maybe. Would your parents let you? What has Ingeld to do with Christ? Alcuin, when he found out his monks really preferred Beowulf in a lot of the ancient epics, quite concerned, echoing Tertullian's question, what has Athens to do with Jerusalem, right? Too often as Christians, I think we want easy answers, don't we? We like to put things into those categories of, if we can say that this music is non-Christian, and Harry Potter is bad, and R-rated movies are off limits, then we don't have to think about them. We can just set them aside, and that's easy. That's nice. And if we say that Christian music is good and Amish romance is good and God's Not Dead is good, then we can say these are safe. And we can label good and bad, and that's a nice little bifurcation. Let's just keep it there. But the problem is we turn off our brains in either case. We aren't being discerning. That's not really in being in the world and not of it. It's not loving the Lord with all our minds. So what do we do with this? Historically, Christians, to stay on the safe side, Christians have often preferred nonfiction to fiction. Leland Ryken says there's no... Leland Ryken, professor of literature, retired now, was professor of literature at Wheaton. There is no valid reason for the perennial Christian preference of biography, history, and the newspaper to fiction and poetry. The former tell us what happened, while literature tells us what happens. To illustrate this, I have a poem here by Miller Williams, the father of Lucinda Williams. Anyone? Lucinda Williams, anyone? Kind of, okay, yeah, kind of a cross between Joan Baez and... who's the Janet Joplin and Bob Dylan, maybe. Put those three together, you've got... anyway, her dad wrote this poem, Miller Williams, How Step by Step We Have Come to Understand. In the 16th century, Nicholas Copernicus told us the earth was a ball, and what was worse was not the center of the universe. Well, and so, we wanted to know, where does that leave us in the scheme of things? Wherever it left us, we were just about learning to live with it when 3 centuries later, Charles Darwin grabbed our attention with the news that we were cousins to the kangaroos. And so we wanted to know, where does that leave us in the scheme of things? Wherever it left us, we were just about learning to live with it when 1/2 a century later, Albert Einstein, changing the meaning of tomorrow and the where of place, told us there only seemed to be time and space. So we wanted to know, where does that leave us in the scheme of things? Wherever it left us, we were just about learning to live with it when here came Flannery O'Connor and Hank Williams to tell us that no one has ever been loved the way everybody wants to be loved. And that's hard. That's hard. Literature tells us what happens, how life is. To make this point and to introduce my students to the need for a more nuanced approach to literature, early in the year, 9th grade, within the first week, I read them this story. I'm going to read it to you. It's very short. It's called With Bated Breath. Sorry, I'm a little nervous. I got a phone call from Mrs. Trethaway today, buddy. What do you think she was calling about? I don't know. Nathan, 5 years old, stared intently at his toes as he answered his father. I bet you do. Nathan's father was a young 40. He had gained a few pounds since his college football days and had just enough gray in his hair to look distinguished. Nathan's mother had wanted to hang on to her career as long as possible, so they were a bit older when they started their family. Elizabeth, Nathan called her Elizabeth, was Nathan's little sister and just a year old. Nathan's folks didn't want any more children, but they adored the two they had. Maybe it's because Nick was throwing frogs at the playground wall, and I told him that wasn't right, and he told me I couldn't tell him what was right and wrong, and I said could too, and he said again I couldn't, so I hit him. Maybe it's because of that, maybe. Maybe, partner. Do you think you should have hit Nick? Maybe not. Maybe not is right. I can understand, though, you being upset with him, killing frogs. He didn't just kill him, Nathan interjected. He splatted him. Nathan's father smiled. I see. Well, he is right about one thing. But you can't tell him what's right and what isn't. See, what you and I think is wrong might not be wrong to somebody else. Does that make sense, buddy? Uh-huh, replied Nathan, though he wasn't sure it did. Good, then let's go in and say goodnight to your sister, and then it's time for you to brush your teeth and get to bed, buddy. Nathan smiled, knowing that his punishment for fighting could have been a lot worse. As the day faded to gray, an overexposed city sky hid the stars behind a veil of reflected neon. Nathan's parents had fallen asleep, watching Letterman on their bedroom TV. Elizabeth was a very good baby, and she slept soundly most nights. Nathan, on the other hand, was having trouble sleeping, partly because he went to bed early and partly because of the butterfinger that he snuck after he brushed his teeth. Whatever the reason, he was up and he smelled smoke. He jumped out of bed and opened his door. Smoke was building in the hall and seemed to be billowing from the kitchen. He threw open his parents' door and jumped between them on the bed. Mama, Dada, we're burning, we're burning. Huh? What? His father, in a daze, instinctively grabbed the phone and dialed 911. Honey, take the kids outside. I'll be down right behind... The operator cut him off. Emergency, what's your name and address? His wife was already grabbing her wedding dress from the closet and calling for Nathan to follow her. The two of them descended the three-story apartment stairway. By the time they got to the door, the apartment alarm was rattling their teeth and soaking the sprinklers were soaking the stairwell. The building had only 6 units, but the stairway was packed with bodies yelling and clamoring for a safe place outside. As Nathan's mother put her hand on the door handle, she froze. Elizabeth. Oh, my. Oh, Elizabeth! She screamed. Just then, a fireman opened the door and startled Nathan's mom. As the tenants pushed through the door past her, they swept Nathan out with them. Oh, please, please, she grabbed the coat of the fireman. Save her! Save my Elizabeth! The fireman briskly but gently escorted her outside. Show me which window, ma'am, he said calmly. By this time, smoke poured out several windows, including Elizabeth's. Nathan's father bolted out the door behind the crowd and regrouped with his family. Where's Elizabeth? He realized the answer as his wife sobbed and pointed to her window. In no time, the fireman had a ladder up and was ascending to the third story. As he entered Elizabeth's room, flames shattered the window right next to hers. The fireman squinted and pointed his light in the direction of a baby's cry. As he approached her crib, he heard something stir to his right. He glanced over and saw the hamster that Nathan had given to his sister for her first birthday. It was really Nathan's hamster, but he insisted on sharing it with his sister. The name Buster was scribbled with green crayon on a piece of cardboard inside the cage. The fireman stopped for a moment and thought. His light illuminated the hamster and then moved back to the crib. Elizabeth's mother held her breath as she saw the black boots meet the top rungs of the ladder. But her exhale did not bring a cry of joy. The fireman guided himself down with his left hand, and under his right, he carried a cage containing one hamster. Nathan's father met the fireman at the bottom of the ladder. As they shook hands, Nathan's father said, "It was a fine decision. Not the one I would have made, but a fine decision nonetheless. Thank you." The fireman knelt down and handed a nervous hamster to a dumbstruck 5-year-old. First question I ask them is, Is this a Christian story? What do you think? What do you think?
Depends on what you draw out of it.
Depends on what you draw out of it. Okay? Good? Good, good. Anyone else? It depends on what it's meant to be, okay? What's...
Be a satire, or is that meant to make a statement?
Okay.
Animal life and human life.
Okay. Okay. What was the author's intent, right? Good. Yeah. We need to have a nuanced way of looking at literature to figure that out, don't we? We can't just say this good, this bad, right? This Christian, this not. Which is it? It's commonplace to say, I'm going to let that hang for a little bit, we'll come back to it. It's commonplace to say that the purpose of literature is to teach and delight. But how? How does a story like that delight us? How are we delighted by the fall of the house of Usher or by a good man is hard to find? And what can such works teach us? I was trying to figure these out, as I said, my first year of teaching. And I had the summer prior to my first teaching job, I came across a book edited by Leland Ryken called The Christian Imagination. Has anybody seen this? If you don't have it, buy it. Highly, highly recommend it. And I especially had been impressed by Ryken's own essay in there. There are tons of great stuff in there, but Ryken's own essay called Thinking Christianly About Literature. And my very first day, I was at the copier making copies of this essay to hand out and discuss with my classes. And a more experienced colleague of mine had also just discovered this book that summer. And he was showing up at the copier at the same time with the same essay to hand out to his classes. And so we began talking. And his name's Jeff Hunderfund. Jeff actually was a student of Leland Ryken's, I found out later. we began discussing how to apply Ryken's essay, which isn't, it doesn't give a lot of practical ideas, although it gives us fantastic way of looking at literature. How do we apply that? How do we use it in the classroom? And then Jeff has moved on from Schaefer, and I've continued in the last few years to make connections with other authors and to explore and experiment a bit in the classroom of how do we use what he has here. And so today I just want to give you a brief overview of this framework and provide some practical classroom ideas for applying it, as I said. And if we have time, the handout did finally come around. I was hoping it would be out there early, and as you guys were coming in, I was hoping to save some time and say, read that short story, Wild Plums. And then at the end, we'd have time to discuss it. We may not have time for you to read it and discuss it, but I might still give you a homework assignment with it if you want to do it. So hang on to that. It's a fantastic short story. All right. So time for the whiteboard. More comfortable up here. The first of the three functions that we're going to talk about is experience. You have in your in the book there's a little diagram, and I'm just going to draw the diagram up on the board here, but then I'm going to do some stuff with it. And that's why I wanted it in the notebook there, so you could kind of draw all the same messy arrows that I draw if you want to. If you think more linearly, the left side is for you. The left side just has a nice little outline with the same three words, so you can go either direction. Experience, and then down here I'm going to write, interpretation as the main one and put worldview rather in parentheses, and I'll explain why that is. I've kind of changed that over time, and this is all still in process. In fact, any feedback you guys have at the end to say, hey, I could see it going this way, or you could do this with it, or whatever, I welcome that for sure. This is just a chance to work together. So Frederick Buechner says that in some measure, the story of any one of us is the story of us all. Universal experience. For literature to function, it has to have some universal experience, right? The experience that the characters go through have to, in some way, act as a mirror for us. They must in some way act as a mirror. If we can't relate to it, it won't function, right? Lewis makes the point, C.S. Lewis makes the point in a little essay called We Demand Windows, that it doesn't just act as a mirror, but that good literature must act as a window as well. He says, what then is the good of, and what is even the defense for, occupying our hearts with stories of what never happened and entering vicariously into feelings which we should try to avoid having in our own person? I think, J.D., I think you referred to Plato's Republic in your talk, and that's similar to Plato's. His argument is, why would the philosophy rulers, why should we have them act out parts of characters that aren't worthy of their own, you know, of the people we want them to be? Isn't that bad for them? So that's what Lewis asks here. Why would we occupy our hearts with stories that we feel we'd want to avoid in our own person? Or fixing our inner eye earnestly on things that can never exist? The nearest I have yet got to an answer is that we seek enlargement of our being. We want to be more than ourselves. Each of us, by nature, sees the whole world from one point of view with a perspective and a selectiveness peculiar to himself. We want to see with other eyes, to imagine with other imaginations, to feel with other hearts, as well as with our own. We demand windows. Literature as logos, and by that he means by the incarnation, by the incarnated word, right? By the word made flesh, the logos. Literature as the incarnated word, is a series of windows, even of doors. In love, we escape from self into one another. In the moral sphere, every act of justice or charity involves putting ourselves in the other person's place and thus transcending our own competitive particularity. This, so far as I can see, is the specific value or good of literature considered as logos. It admits us to experiences other than our own. End quote. So we have Lewis, talking about the experiences found in literature as a window as well. But it's a window that, so on the one hand, if we go back to mirror for just a minute, there's this simple kind of mirror, right? The joy of, we read a Bildungsroman and we say, ah, that reminds me of my childhood and of my own coming of age. Or we read a love story and we say, that helps me to reminisce about my own courtship or my own heartache. And that's kind of the simple way that literature is a mirror. But it goes deeper than that. In this way that Lewis is talking of a window, when we forget ourselves and we become empathetic with somebody else and we enter into the other that has been in many ways kind of the scary thing for us, suddenly we see ourselves from their perspective, not just as we know ourselves. It's a lot like looking out a window. And you look, you can see a view out the window, right? I might look in my backyard and be looking out and think, wow, what a beautiful yard I have. I don't, full of weeds. But what a beautiful yard I have, and I'm looking out at it. And then as the focus changes, oh, there I am in the window. You know what I'm saying? There's a reflection there of myself in the window. It's all about the focus. And I think that's what Lewis is getting at, is this kind of window mirror effect with literature. We look through a new vista into a totally new world, and pretty before we know it, the focus changes, and there's this huge mirror being held up back at us. So the experience is both a mirror and a window. G.K. Chesterton, in The Ethics of Elfland, the chapter in Orthodoxy, he says, these tales say that apples were golden only to refresh the forgotten moment when we found that they were green. They make rivers run with wine only to make us remember for one wild moment that they run with water. We enter into a new experience to be reminded of our own. The window mirror effect reveals the underlying themes of a work. Often when we teach literature, at least when I was taught literature and when I first started teaching it, I would And every textbook does this. So many lesson plans you see are, here are the themes of this work. Before you read the work, here are the themes you're looking for. I don't do that so much. I had some students say, how do we know these are the themes? Why is this just some list of things that you came up with or somebody came up with and said, these are in there, go find them? And I thought that's a fantastic question, right? So as we work through this, we'll see that as experiences and the way those experiences are interpreted by characters, as there's a pattern, as there's a repeat, as the form that the author uses, you can tell by his form that he's intentionally repeating something. That's where themes come from. It's those experiences and interpretations that bubble up throughout the whole thing, that are the underlining universal experience that are beneath the whole story that keep bubbling up. That's where they come from. And students can discover those without being told ahead of time. And it's fantastic when they do. When we read Huck Finn and they say, he's got this thing about prayer only working for certain people, and the religious people kind of, he doesn't have a lot of, but doesn't put a lot of stock in them, right? But man, he believes in these superstitions, doesn't he? And over again, they start seeing religion and superstition. Now that's where it's at. And I have a student ask, is there a theme of religion versus superstition in some way in here? Was Twain purposely doing that? Yes, he was. What does that mean? Well, wait. Let's wait on that. Let's just talk about the story first. We'll get to authorial intent later in the form. We look at the form. But yes, that's definitely there. They can pick those out. Ryken again. The subject of literature is human experience. The thing that sets literature off from philosophy and the thought disciplines is that it embodies human experience in concrete form rather than presenting abstract propositions. Literature gives the example rather than the precept. It embodies experience in event and character, in image and in metaphor. The incarnational, there it is again, the incarnational nature of literature has important implications for settling the perennial question of whether literature tells the truth. On one of the levels of truth in literature is truthfulness to human experience and external reality. Literature overwhelmingly tells the truth at this level. Writers are sensitive observers to reality. So the motto of Schaefer Academy is teaching the permanent things, truth, goodness, and beauty. Literature, to function as literature, has to have enough universal truth in it that every human being can say, I get it. It has to function as truth at some level. That doesn't mean it's always true. It has to have, maybe as Colbert would say, a good amount of truthiness. But experience loosely correlates then with truth, and we'll come back again to that idea. All right. Again, some of the problems in the way that Christians have thought about, especially evangelicals in the last 100 years maybe, have thought about these sorts of things. I was at the Festival for Faith and Writing at Calvin College several years ago, and there were some publishers there, and they have publishing guidelines. And some of the more major Christian publishers and their publishing guidelines for fiction, there were three guidelines I remember specifically that really bothered me. One was there can be no cussing in a novel that they'll publish. One was any sin in that novel must have a direct consequence that is directly tied to that sin by the end of the story. And one is somebody has to get saved. Someone must get saved. I think there must be some new thing that somebody has to be either Amish or colonial now too. When I look through the CBD catalog, but that just struck me as not reality. And what we're doing is, I think, if those are there, and that's not every Christian publisher, but that any of them had that, it bothered me. I thought Christianity is the story of reality. It's the ultimate story of reality. And what we're teaching is the exact opposite, is that Christianity is not really real if it can't include those things. Worldview. I used to use Worldview Here more. I actually shy away from it a bit now because many of my students want to go instantly to the chapters in James Sire's Universe Next Door because we use that in our Worldview class. And so they want to say, oh, so is the author an existentialist? Is he a nihilist? Is he a deist? You know, is this character this? They want the big worldview labels, and they want to go quickly that direction. And I want to say, whoa, slow down. We're not thinking of it that way. We're really thinking just literally, how do these characters view the world? How do they interpret their experiences? And so I found myself using the word interpretation much more than worldview. Ryken actually uses the word perspective in his essay, which I think it's confusing because when we get to form, we're going to talk about what perspective the author chooses to use, whether it's first person or third person, etc. And so I didn't want to get them confused there. So interpretation is the word I've settled on. It seems to work pretty well. So characters have an experience, and then they interpret that experience. And this happens over and over and over again throughout the story, throughout the novel. In fact, what's real interesting is when you have multiple characters having the same experience, but different interpretations. Now there's conflict, right? Now there's, which character do I side with more? Maybe neither. Maybe I kind of see both sides. But that's when it gets real interesting. When we have, Banquo and Macbeth, they both heard the same thing from the witches. And at first, they joked about it. Their initial interpretation, which was very off the cuff, is, your sons will be kings. You will be king. Isn't that funny? And then almost instantly, Banquo says, but still 'tis strange. And oftentimes, to win us to our harm, the instruments of darkness tell truths. Win us with honest trifles to betray us in deepest consequence. Whereas, upon further reflection, Macbeth's interpretation is, if it were done, when 'tis done, 'twere well it were done quickly. Right? And so they have vastly different interpretations of that experience. And that also brings up the issue of form. Not only does Banquo have a different interpretation of that experience at the level of the story, but at the level of the craft, Shakespeare is foreshadowing, right? So we can tie in the way that the form and the interpretation of the character fit together. And the more that we can do that, the more we can begin to discern what's the author's intent, what's really happening. We have to be careful not to equate the author's intent with any one character's, and not with the narrator's either. I think we often forget that a narrator or a speaker of a poem is not the same as the author, right? And students especially need to be reminded of that over and over and over again. So with Bated Breath, the story I read to you a bit ago, we have a few characters, none of them very well-rounded, admittedly. They're fairly flat overall. But they have some experiences, right? And they interpret them differently. So let's start with the, what experience, name one of the experiences that the characters have in that story I read to you.
The fight at school.
The fight at school, okay. Great, I just smacked that. The fight at school, yes. And so you have two kids who have that experience, Nathan and his friend, Nick is his friend's name. We don't really know Nick's interpretation of it we kind of do. We know that he said, you can't tell me what's wrong, but was that a reflective interpretation? Who knows? What we do know is the way that the discussion of it later, right? Nathan and his father. How did Nathan interpret his experience with the fight at school when he's talking to his father about it? What do you say? Aaron. Nathan and his father are discussing the fight that they had at school. What was Nathan's interpretation of the fight?
I was on my phone at the beginning of the story.
Okay. Okay, I got you. My bad. Amanda.
My friend was wrong and I was right.
Okay.
Okay,
my friend was wrong, and I was right, and I had to prove that, and so I hit him, right? What was the dad's interpretation of that?
He
of the interaction?
Shouldn't have fought.
Shouldn't have hit him. What else?
We can't tell him what's right and wrong.
Yeah, we can't tell him what's right and wrong. Right? We can't tell him what's right and wrong. Okay? What's another experience that they have together?
The fire.
The fire. It's the most obvious one, right? That's the kind of culminating experience. They all have the fire. How do they interpret what happens there? Okay.
But his wife was probably very angry. She told him explicitly, "Save my daughter."
Okay, so the wife we know is her cry. How does that? Elizabeth's mother held her breath. She saw the black moots. Her exhale did not bring a cry of joy. That's as much as we get of her interpretation, but we know she's not happy, right? We can imply maybe devastated, but we don't know much beyond that. Yes, sir. Yes, she did go for her wedding dress first and forgot the child, which maybe we could excuse to it's chaos and what's going on and why did she do that? You know, we do stupid things sometimes. All these moms are going, no way. No, let me just tell you, I have a friend who will remain unnamed. He's my boss. treading on thin water, or thin ice, thin water. He was at the beach, and they're out at on a sandbar with his family, and someone saw a shadow in the water. Somebody started yelling shark, and this guy's wife went barreling into shore screaming, and left my buddy holding their two kids on the sandbar. And he's like, where was that maternal instinct? It turns out it was a manatee, so they were okay. But so I'm just saying it's possible. But yes, I think there maybe is a hint there, right? Is that with a story as short as this, every detail should count. So there's a clue. What else do we have about the interpretation of the fire? Yes. A nervous hamster is handed a dumbstruck five-year-old. What? Yes? Who punched a friend because he was killing frogs. So it's not that the kid's all for letting the hamster burn, but he has some sense of justice, but he also has some sense of levels, right? Yeah. When we finished the story, how did you feel? Say it again. Terrible. Yeah. Kind of sucker punched, right? So, was that intentional? Yes. That was intentional, wasn't it? The students, after I hear them say over and over again, oh, that's horrible! Who could write... Who's the evil person? How could the... They just start going off about how horrible this is. And I say, you might be surprised to know that you've actually met the author. What? In fact, you're talking to him. And they have no idea what to do with that. And that, was this before you were a Christian? No. No. I wrote it in college as an apologetic piece for people who I was tired of hearing guys on my dorm floor saying, oh, you know, believe whatever you want to believe, man. It's, you know, you can't tell anybody what's right or wrong. And I wanted to bring that to its logical conclusion, right? In fact, we put it out in a little magazine at the time with this on the cover. I'm okay. I'm okay. You're okay. He's okay. The point that I want to make with that, though, is that form, one of the things that form does is it sets a tone. We can tell something from the tone of what the author thinks. It's the same, I use, you know, in the classroom I'll use this example, tone. Students are much a much more quickly recognized tone from a movie, right? Bum, 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 ba-dum, bum, ba-dum. Minor thirds, make you scary. Right? You have, everyone knows, oh, yeah, Darth Vader. But it's vaudevillian, isn't it? You know, as soon as you hear that music, you want to go, boo, hiss! And you're supposed to. Star Wars is such a vaudeville show, really. And then, of course, major fifth, da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da, right? Big major fifths and fourths is what we have there, and it's the hero coming out, Luke Skywalker. That's tone. And authors do the same thing. It's just a little more difficult to pinpoint sometimes. A little more difficult to do as an author with words rather than music. But it's there, and we get a sense of it through all kinds of things. And often we get a sense of it through the perspective. Right? In the form, this the perspective that's used, so I'm talking first person, third person, etc. With Huckleberry Finn, it's written in first person from Huck Finn's vantage point. That works really well, especially when he says some really offensive things. If an adult said those offensive things, it wouldn't fly. We would just read that aghast at what they say. But Huck, he's so naive and so easily, he's so malleable, he's so easily influenced that he gets a pass. And it actually works for Twain's purposes, right? So the perspective, the form, helps an awful lot for us to understand a little bit more about how the author might be interpreting things. The third person in Bated Breath, I used a limited third person. It's third person, but it's certainly through the eyes of Nathan. It's his kind of story. And so the question, one of the questions we want to ask when we're in form, we're talking about form, is with whom does the author want us to sympathize? And to what degree? With whom does the author want us to sympathize? And to what degree, or in what ways? Say, in what ways? It's not always an all or nothing. With Bated Breath, it is. I want you to sympathize wholeheartedly with that little boy. There are other stories that's not the case. Dr. Heidegger's Experiment by Hawthorne. Just read that. I've been having a fun doing this kind of thing, working through with a book club of parents, actually. Parents who say, I'd love to know how you teach literature to our kids. So on Monday nights, I've been getting together, and we've been having wine and hors d'oeuvres and talking literature with a bunch of parents this summer. It's been fun. And one of the Dr. Heidegger's Experiment was one of the stories we just did. And one of the parents said, there's nobody I want to identify with in this story. There's nobody who's sympathetic in this story. What does that mean? That's a great question. You're right. They're all horrible. Heidegger seems a little less horrible at first than the other four, and then you get to the end and you realize, holy cow. Are you guys, how many of you are familiar with this story? I won't say much more about it then. Read it. Fantastic story. A lot to dig into with this. And at the end you realize, no, Hawthorne, that's his whole point. He's an anti-transcendentalist. He's fighting against the transcendentalists who think that all of mankind is wonderful and good and can transcend, you know, all things by their own little imaginations and instincts. And he's saying, no, there's sin in the world. The world is an evil place. And so at the end of the story, it's no wonder that you can't sympathize with any human being in it. They're all bad. We're all bad. That's kind of the point he's making, right? But that question still works. With whom does the author want us to sympathize? Nobody. That can be a valid answer there. And to what degree? So in some stories, you'll find yourself going, well, I get what he's saying here, and I get what they're doing there, and that raises some questions, right? I've jumped all over. In this section, there's obviously need for discernment when we're talking about interpretation. Well, I mean, we'll go back to interpretation for a bit, where there's obviously need, there's need for discernment all the way through. There's, when it comes to interpretation, as again, I really liked your talk yesterday, Jonathan, JD, is that right? Okay, JD. And that was, you said something along the lines of literature being seductive, or can be. That is, and so, yes, it's meant to be. It draws us in a way that nonfiction doesn't. That's what makes it powerful, because it's plugging into something inside us. And that can make it both really effective at getting across ideas, even though it's not primarily about ideas, but they're there, and it is, kind of. But it also can make it dangerous, right? And so as teachers, we want to be helping our students to evaluate the interpretations of the characters. And once we get around to the form and how the author, with whom does he want us to sympathize? Ah, he wants us to sympathize with this character, but should we? But should we sympathize with that character? And or maybe, oh, I think he wants me to identify with this character, but I actually identify more with this character. When I get done reading The Scarlet Letter, I think Hawthorne, he sure seems to like Hester an awful lot. I relate with Dimmesdale a lot more. And I think there's a case can be made that Dimmesdale is the more sympathetic character, actually. There's a lot of discussion and debate that can happen around that. We actually have some pretty fiery debates over The Scarlet Letter in class, and it's a lot of fun. But these kinds of questions of whom does the author want us to sympathize, with whom does he want us to sympathize, who should we, who do we, why, is this good, is this bad, what kind of worldviews do these characters have, what can we tell about their worldview from their interpretations, what can we tell about the author's worldview from the interpretations that we think this author is pushing us towards, and then how do we evaluate that from a Christian worldview? And the last part is a pretty big question, and one that we could have many more talks on. I'll just steer you in the direction of one work that came up yesterday in the discussion as well. But Jerem Bars, who teaches at Covenant Seminary in St. Louis, he also is he's pretty well versed in the arts, and I think he started the Francis Schaeffer Center there. I should know these things. I don't. I think he started that. But he has a book called Echoes of Eden, and it's about Christianity and the arts. And he says that all literature, or all art actually, all art and literature, falls into one of three categories. Echoes of Eden in its original glory, echoes of Eden that is lost to us, and echoes of Eden restored. And so, helpful categories, I think, when students ask, "Is this character, is this character a Christian or not a Christian?" Well, what do you hear in their interpretations of their experiences? Well, I hear a desire for this that seems good, but then I see an action of this that seems like they're interpreting this wrongly. It's a mixed bag, right? But it's all in some way an echo of the longing of that all creation has for that restoration. And so Bars gives a few more specific tools that could be helpful for you there. And he actually goes into some specific works at the end and gives examples. Works his way through some Jane Austen and Harry Potter and I don't know what else is in there. I forgot the other ones in there, but several pieces that he works through. Form, I'll continue on with that a bit. Form is where we delight in the literature, right? And we could delight in the whole thing. I'm just running over here to check the time. Oh. Can somebody just tell me? Oh, we're doing well. Okay, thank you. We delight, and we can delight in much of it, but the form is the craft. This is where the art takes place. And this is where we can help students to see literary devices, characterization, all those things that we want them to appreciate about the author and his craft, all those things we want them to imitate in their own writing. But we want them to see how those things connect with the rest of it. And so that's some of what we've hit on that a little bit already, but the way that Twain again, in his satire in Huck Finn, he does this sucker punch thing over and over again where he gets you laughing. He uses humor so well and then makes it deadly serious all of a sudden. And it's super effective for the purposes of interpretation. When Huck pretends to be Tom and he's fooled Aunt Sally, and we're all laughing, and then she says, when she finds out that a boiler blew on the steamship, and she says, "Oh, did anybody get hurt?" And he says, "No, ma'am, killed a nigger." And you get hit in the gut, and you realize, whoa. And it hurts all the more because you were laughing just a page earlier. You were laughing all the way up until you get that shot. That's form functioning in a way that's brilliant for the point of the author, for the author's purposes. And when students can see how that form connects with interpretation, it helps them to understand the literature, helps them to understand their own writing as well. Genre. Genre also is part of form, obviously, and genre helps to do a number of things. The quality of the form, and I would argue along with the genre, is what helps us to suspend our disbelief. So let's connect form with, boy, that's messy, form with genre, with experience. I have never had the experience, let's talk about experience as a window. I've never had the experience of flying to another planet at all, let alone in a perfect metal, a perfect sphere made of metal with a giant window on it. Never done it. And in fact, I don't think it can be done. I don't think a big metal sphere with a giant window is going to make it to Mars. But when C.S. Lewis writes Out of the Silent Planet, and I know that it's an homage to H.G. Wells, and the genre is this kind of old-school science fiction, I can't wait to ride that giant silver ball with the big window up to another planet. I can't wait to get there in that thing. I can suspend my disbelief, set it aside, because the genre allows me to, and because the form is done so well. It's written so well that I can do it. I don't believe in talking pigs, but when George Orwell writes a fairy tale, I'm convinced, right? I'm convinced at that point. So genre helps us a lot with being able to suspend our disbelief, and that's part of the form and part of what tells us what the author's trying to do. When we realize that Twain is writing the genre of satire, that helps us an awful lot with understanding why we shouldn't censor the words in that book, because it'll lose all of its power. Ryken, again, a Christian view of literature should stand as a corrective to the prevailing utilitarian spirit of a technological society. Though in fact Christians have often perpetuated the utilitarian outlook to the disparagement of literature, the example of the Bible confirms the importance of literary form and beauty. If the message of the Bible were all that mattered, there would have been no good reason for biblical poets to put their utterances into intricately patterned verse form, or for biblical storytellers to compose masterfully compact and carefully designed stories. In God's economy, I love this line, in God's economy, the writers of the Bible didn't have something better to do with their time and ability than to be artistic to the glory of God. The writer of Ecclesiastes speaks for other biblical authors as well as for himself when he tells us that he arranged his material, quote, with great care, and that he, quote, sought to find pleasing words, or as the ESV says, words of delight. Ecclesiastes 12, 9 through 10. So we come around full circle. We have beauty here. Oops. We have truth in the experiences, and then they interpret those truths in some with some moral code. So we have the true, the good, and the beautiful in some measure. And we want the students to be able to say, to what degree are these experiences true? To what degree are these interpretations good, morally good? And to what degree is this form beautiful? And they all depend on one another. The beauty of it is going to depend to some degree on the goodness of it and the truth of it, right? But we can have a more nuanced way of critiquing things now. We'll get to that in a minute. Just about done here. We're going to give you some practical classroom applications and then even outside of the classroom applications. The intellectual usefulness, last quote from Ryken for today, the intellectual usefulness of literature is not that it necessarily tells us the truth about an issue, but rather that it serves as a catalyst to thinking about the great issues of life. I'm going to read that one again. The intellectual usefulness of literature is not that it necessarily tells us the truth about an issue, but rather it serves as a catalyst to thinking about the great issues of life. So it's not that this is going to be completely true and completely good and completely beautiful, whatever we read or listen to or watch, but it's going to raise the questions about the true, the good, and the beautiful. And it helps us to bring our students back to examining that and to appreciate what is good and true and beautiful. In the classroom, I present them through lectures like this, spaced out a little more, but lectures like this. But beyond that, we do graded discussions using these. So we'll put together, I don't have desks, I have these little tables that are really moldable, kind of, it's fun. So we put them all together in one big kind of Harkness thing, and they all sit around, and they come in after a reading with 3 to 5 discussion questions. And those discussion questions have to be, and we use a pokey green ball that I call the chartreuse orb of death, that gets thrown around. It's like the conch shell, you know, whoever has it speaks. And you don't have to raise your hand, and you can pass it to somebody who doesn't necessarily want to speak, but kind of gently invite them in by throwing the pokey ball at them. There are better and worse ways of doing that, of course. They have 3 to 5 questions, and these questions are going to revolve around experience, interpretation, and form. So they're thinking in these terms always and examining the literature from in these ways. So maybe when reading The Scarlet Letter, some of my commitments, some questions on experience along the lines of, what is universal in Dimmesdale's experience? And someone might answer, well, secret sin does cause anxiety. Secret sin also causes empathy for other sinners. Can, right? Perhaps secret sin can make us self-absorbent, causing otherwise observant individuals to be oblivious to what's happening around them, as Dimmesdale is with Chillingworth. Interpretation questions. Why do Dimmesdale and Hester have such different views of the afterlife? When they start talking about where they're going when they die, they interpret it quite differently. Hester says, "We'll be together forever, surely. We'll be married at that heavenly altar, won't we, Dimmesdale?" And he says, don't be so quick. We've sinned against a holy God. I don't know. Why do they have different interpretations? And there's one with, which one does Hawthorne want us to sympathize with? It's actually kind of unclear which one he does. Hawthorne's a pretty complex guy, and I like that about him. How does Hester interpret her scarlet letter versus the way that others interpret it, right? So they don't have to be super deep. That's not that really that deep of a question for a 9th or 10th grader. Once we've gone through this a few times, say, oh, interpretation. Yeah, she has one interpretation for this obvious symbol, the scarlet letter, and others have different interpretations for it. Why is that? Let's talk about those. Form, why does Hawthorne include the prophet Nathan in his allusion to David and Bathsheba? It's not super obvious at first, but it's there. Why? That seems like it was an intentional allusion. Allusion is a literary device that falls under form. Why does he do it? What's he trying to say? Does Hawthorne want his reader to sympathize with the Puritans? Why not? No, he doesn't. Why doesn't he? Why is Chillingworth named Chillingworth? And why do they call him a leech? Right? How is Hawthorne's use of Lytoti effective? They can bring in the, as they learn different literary devices, they can ask questions about those. How is it effective? It's very effective. All right, and so we do these discussions. I won't go into how I grade all of that because we're running out of time. Journals. For Huck Finn, they do 15 journal entries. And again, the journal entries have to be referring to one or more of the three functions, every one of their entries. They don't have to go through all three of them, but they're going to refer to one of them. And so I say pick an episode that you just liked. Find the first episode that made you laugh out loud in the story. What did you, you know? Oh, it was when Tom makes them all ambuscade the Arabs, which is really just a Sunday school picnic, right? So you liked that. Tell me about that experience. How was that interpreted differently by two different characters? Oh, Tom thought it was an adventure. Huck thought it was stupid. If they write about that, and they don't go any farther than that, that's fantastic in a journal entry. Because later on, we'll come back to, they can bring that up. In fact, we'll also do these discussions with the journals. So we start with the questions, and then once we move to journals, they'll start reading journal entries, and then we can interact on those. So another student will say, well, yeah, because for Huck, even though Huck always is looking up to Tom's adventures in one sense, but in another sense, Huck's the only one who's really living adventure. Tom's are all make-believe. They're all pretend. Good. So we can have some discussions along those lines with the journal. Then, of course, papers, literary analysis papers. And when we get to the paper, where they realize their journals have been invention for their paper, so they've already have a bunch of material for their paper, they're going to have to make some judgment, make a thesis based on these three functions. But they're also going to have some outside reading, depending on which novel it is. But later in the year, I give them some other literary criticism, a couple essays on Twain, for instance, for Huck Finn. And then they're going to be able to use this to judge what other critics think about the work. So when they read a Frederick Buechner essay about Huck Finn, and Buechner makes some assertions about the interpretation, about what Twain is trying to do there, they can look and say, is that really held up by the text? When I go back and I look at the experience that these guys had and the way they interpreted it, and then the way that I think Twain is interpreting it, and then the way that Buechner is interpreting Twain, I'm not sure I agree. And they can interact. They can continue. So you can continue to interact on that level. When they're writing papers, too, this is great to point out that these two are on the level of story, and this is on the level of the page. And what I mean by that is when they write, I want them writing. Of course, when they're writing about the literature, about the story, it should be in literary present tense. They want to be writing in present tense because the story is always happening. And so if they're writing about the experiences and the interpretations of the characters, I don't want them to bring up a page number either. I don't want them to say that on page 25, Dimmesdale grips his heart. Dimmesdale doesn't know there's a page 25. I don't want them to. I want them to say, after seeing Hester at the governor's mansion, Dimmesdale grips his heart. Now we've got a reason for it, right? Dimmesdale does know that he saw Hester, and he does know that he gripped his heart after seeing Hester. He doesn't know he did it on page 25. And so when they're writing about the experiences of the character and their interpretation, I want them to talk about time in terms of the story. This is story level. But when they're talking about the form, when they jump to, and here's how Twain, or here's how Hawthorne did that, or here's how whoever, then you can talk about the chapter. Because now we're talking about the page itself, what's written on the page. And you'd write in past tense because the author really did write it a while ago. So when you're talking about form, and then it gives us a chance to work in verb shifting as well. How do you work verb shifting into a paper? So some of the way that works into papers. Lastly, very quickly, pop music, movies. It's a lot of fun to use this with that and help them to see, oh, I can analyze culture and think about, I don't have to ask, is this a Christian band? I can say, what's the song saying? And to what degree, whether or not they're labeled a Christian band or not, some students have found that, oh, this stuff on the Christian radio actually form-wise isn't that great, and sometimes their theology is really pretty sloppy. And they're not as Christian maybe as some other guys that don't call themselves Christian bands, right? And so they're able to evaluate more nuanced way. We don't have time. You have Wild Plums, a fantastic story. I'd encourage you to ask yourself some of these questions or work together maybe over coffee or a post-dinner beverage of another sort while go through Wild Plums. I think you'll find it a blast, and there are a lot of really nuanced interpretations, and there's a lot going on in that little story. Read it a couple times. Particularly, ask questions about the mother. A lot of fun. So thank you very much. Thank you. Just a little over. Was it? Oh, good. Oh, thank you.